This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After last week's dizzying drop on the market, stock rebound prices rebounded yesterday, and so far they're down 197 points today. That after the U.S. and European governments announced plans to buy stock in private banks. But if fears of catastrophe ebbed a bit, there is near universal expectation that hard times lie ahead. More unemployment, more bankruptcies, and more foreclosures as the economy shrinks. It's harder for companies, large and small, to borrow money, and many face difficult decisions about layoffs and cutbacks to keep the business afloat. More and more families see credit lines cut too. So whether the decisions are made at the kitchen table, in the boardroom, or at your desk, how are you changing your plans for uncertain times? Later in this hour, as the days to the election wind down, undecided voters get all the attention, but writer Ezra Klein argues they aren't really undecided at all. So what about you? Email us, talk@npr.org. But first, hunkering down for hard times, tell us about your contingency plans. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Janet Hildreck. We spoke to her earlier this month. She's a partner in the business Tree Lovers Floors and joins us from her store in San Francisco. Nice to have you back.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me today.
And Janet, the last time you were on the show, your company was facing the prospect of having to cut payroll in half. What happened?
Well, we pretty much followed out with that plan. We didn't quite cut it in half, but we did have to lay off, I would say, about a third of our field employees who were all very valuable to us. So it was really a pretty difficult thing to do.
I imagine that's it's got to be one of the worst days of your life.
It was. It was very sad. It was stressful. We didn't get much sleep the night before up until, you know, the final hour. We weren't sure who we were laying off still because we really didn't want to get rid of anyone.
Those decisions are never easy.
No, they're not.
I wonder, have you been having difficulties with credit?
We have been having difficulties with credit because I was pretty well set up with both business lines of credit and a home equity line of credit, which unfortunately was with IndyMac. And so we definitely don't have the credit that we thought we could rely on in times such as these.
IndyMac was the bank in California that went under about a month and a half ago?
Correct. And so that was I had a pretty large equity line of credit. And it was, it was pulled. It was actually frozen, but since the company no longer exists, I don't think I'm going to get that back.
And how does that affect your business?
Well, it certainly certainly forces us to make contingency plans up front as opposed to when the time comes. So in other words, I've had to really quickly assess all of our spending and all of our expenses and just start trimming and cutting back as much as I can.
And obviously you want to do that early rather than late. You're thinking about the survival of the business, but when it means you're letting employees go, it's just awful.
It's what?
It's just awful.
It is. It is. And what's worse than that is the prospect of not being able to stay in business at all. And I've talked to several companies over the past several weeks, and it's everywhere. It's not a matter of making bad business decisions. It's just that's how our economy is. And I don't think a lot of people are talking about it, but when asked, certainly almost everyone that I speak with, whether it's attorney offices, designers, architects, they're all having layoffs. And I think it's what I've come to is that we all need to just kind of shift gears a little bit and downshift and make adjustments so that we can get through the hard times.
We wish you the best of luck.
Great. Thank you so much, Neil.
Janet Hildreck, a partner in the business Tree Lovers Floors, with us today from her store in San Francisco in California. Well, obviously, this affects not only businesses, large and small, it affects people as well. Joining us now is Liz Pulliam-Weston, a personal finance columnist with us from NPR West in Culver City. Nice to have you back on the show, too.
Thanks, Neil. It's nice to be back.
And we're finding that people are finding, just families, people with credit cards are finding their lines of credit being whacked in by a third, by half. This is spreading throughout the economy and into people's personal lives.
It absolutely is. I think we saw it first with home equity lines of credit getting frozen, and we've been seeing credit card companies freezing credit limits, lowering credit limits. Used to be you only had to deal with that if you were behind on your payments, you know, if you were having significant credit difficulties. Now people who have been keeping up with their payments are seeing this happen.
And is there anything people can do to ride out this wave?
Oh, there's a lot of things people can do, and that's something we need to focus on is the stuff that you have within your power, since the larger economy is totally outside your power. Looking at your budget, looking at the ways that you're spending, trying to find ways to cut and put aside some kind of savings cushion can help you ride this out. If you lose your job, the money's there to help you pay your bills. Even if you don't, it gives you a sense of, you know, comfort, being able to sleep at night, knowing you've got that little cash pad sitting there.
And first off, the advice we've had heard for the last dozen years has not changed. If you can, pay down the credit card.
Absolutely. Unless you're so far in that you're having trouble making your minimum payments, in that case, you are a good candidate for either credit counseling, a debt management payoff plan, or possibly bankruptcy. And what I worry about is people who are struggling to pay these debts, who continue throwing money at them when really they can't be paid off and they're going to wind up in bankruptcy anyway. So if you are in the position where you can't make your minimums, make one appointment with a legitimate credit counselor. They're affiliated with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Make a second appointment with a bankruptcy attorney so you know all your options.
Whether you're just a family or whether you're a business, small or large, what are your contingency plans? What are you doing as we face uncertain times ahead? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Let's start with Donnie, and Donnie is with us from Louisville in Kentucky.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead, please.
We don't really have a contingency. We don't have the money to have a contingency. Lost our house. Lost a business. I was self-employed as a mortgage banker. Lost the business. Lost the house. Now work for a large corporation that is in the middle of layoffs. And single dad, three kids, and there's nothing left. I'm short every month, and there's no credit cards left. I can't even afford to get an attorney to file bankruptcy. so it's literally for us. It's less than a paycheck away from being homeless with not a lot of prospects. I currently work one job. I'm in the middle of getting a second job, so I will actually work 40 hours during the day, and then I will work a third shift for 30 hours.
And how old are your kids?
I've got an 11-year-old boy and 28-year-old girls.
And obviously, if you're the last hired, since you just got this job, could be the first fired.
Yeah, the cost of health care has gone up, the cost of food has gone up, the cost of gas has gone up, and it's put us in a position where I honestly don't know. If something were to happen to my current day position, we would be at a homeless shelter. I honestly don't know what to do or how to do it.
Liz, I obviously Donnie's near wit's end, but is there any advice you might have for him?
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking situation, Donnie, and I'm so sorry this is happening to you and your kids. The first thing, when you mentioned that you don't know if you have enough money to file for bankruptcy, there are less expensive ways to file. I try to get a hold of your local bar association, see if there's a legal aid society that can walk you through it just to see if, you know, you might be a good prospect. And most bankruptcy attorneys will give you a free consultation just to see if this is an option for you. So that's something to think about. And worst case scenario, there are food stamps. There are states have programs to help with child care. So
it's
scary
kind of funny. I've gone and applied for those programs, and I make just over the amount to qualify.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So I'm caught right in the middle. I mean, there's nothing. You know, I need to. You know, basically, I need to lose my job in order to qualify for those programs, which in turn would wipe us out. So
yeah. You have to be pretty far down to qualify for food stamps, definitely. There are other benefits, though, and I'd go to govbenefits.gov, govbenefits.gov. They have sort of an interactive calculator. You can just start. It takes a while to go through it, but they will dig up all the programs that you might be eligible for that could give you a little bit of a break in any case. And again, I'm so sorry you're facing all this.
We wish you the best of luck, Donnie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Businesses, of course, face difficult times as well, as we heard earlier from Janet Hildreth. Joining us is Todd McCracken. He's president of the National Small Business Association with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And the challenges facing small businesses, that's got to be credit, has got to be right at the top.
It's right at the top. It's been increasing for, I would say, a year and a half in terms of the problems faced by small companies. In fact, we did a survey that showed us that two-thirds of our members had said they'd been directly affected by the credit crunch before this crisis even happened. So the freezing of those markets in the last couple of weeks has had a tremendous effect on folks.
And have you seen any signs that this is easing?
There's some a little bit of evidence, but mostly from economists and others talking about what's happening. I haven't seen much evidence that's really trickled to the small business person yet. Hopefully that'll happen soon.
And do you send out advice to small business owners, or do they call you with, tell us what to do?
Some of both. But, you know, the small business community is so diverse that they really have to take a hard look at where they are in the economy, because there are regional differences, there are differences by industry, and this is really a time where they have to step back and really assess, I think, with a very critical eye, where they are, where their industry is, where their region is, in terms of, is this a short-term problem that they're facing, or is this going to be a long-term road? And that should affect the decisions they make. For instance, you're talking about keeping employees on, which is one of the most difficult decisions a business owner faces in tough times. Well, you know, I would advise people in the main that if they have key employees who are hard to replace, even if we enter a period of high unemployment, they're hard to replace. They should do everything they can to keep those people on board if they have some reason to believe this can turn around soon.
But death of a thousand cuts can happen too.
Absolutely.
Right, stay with us if you will. More on how the dismal economy is affecting you in a moment. What are your contingency plans? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know the economy's lousy. We know many of you are cutting back on spending. Today, we want to go a step further. How is the economy changing your plans for your family, for your business? Tell us about your contingency plans for uncertain times. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are Liz Pulliam-Weston, whose latest book is titled Easy Money, How to Simplify Your Finances and Get What You Want Out of Life, and Todd McCracken, president of the National Small Business Association. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Phil. Phil with us from Canyon Lake in Texas.
Hi, Neil. I love your show.
Thank you.
We're here in Texas. I'm a stay-at-home dad with a six-year-old and a clay artist. I bring my work to small galleries and sell at fine art shows, but, you know, when the economy dips, those necessities go away. People just aren't out there buying art. And although my wife works for a school district and she has a great position, I'm back in the market for a position as a merchant marine captain. That's my other career.
And how is that business going?
Well, you know, that business is actually pretty good simply because, you know, the ships have to come in and the rigs have to be supplied. And it takes a fairly high level of skill and licensing to skipper those vessels. So there is a demand for it if you've got all the right credentials.
And I guess you do, but it also means a lot of time away from home.
Yeah, it's going to, you know, from me being a primary person at home with my daughter to being gone 2 weeks at a time and home for 1 week and then back out again.
It's just 2 weeks at a time, then 1 week home? It's not round-the-world cruises or anything like that?
No, it's based out of the Gulf primarily, but, boy, what a change from, you know, being aboard for 14 days nonstop, you know, as opposed to being able to be in my studio and spend that time with my daughter and my wife.
Yeah, Phil, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And I suppose, Todd McCracken, there are a lot of people in his situation. He's right. When disposable income is suddenly not so disposable, people are going to cut back on things like art.
Oh, absolutely. So folks who are in all kinds of industries like that or crafts like that have to think about what the likely behavior of people is going to be. But again, we don't know yet whether this is a short-term phenomenon. I think it's pretty clear we're going to have some slowdown for a while, but the acuteness of this that we're facing right now might get much better in just a few weeks.
Or a few months.
I think that's the real difficulty from a business planning perspective, is knowing which it is, and I don't think anyone really knows yet.
Let's get Celeste on the line. Celeste with us from Lafayette, Louisiana.
Hi. We're going to do something that might sound kind of crazy, but I figure it can't hurt to try. We're going to put a garden in the backyard. We have lots of sunshine. We can grow stuff year-round here, and if push comes to shove, we're also going to buy chickens, because it takes 3 months for chickens to grow up, and we'll start a little chicken yard. And we have friends who did it recreationally and saved a ton of money, and money's what's hurting us. We have a small business that's probably going to dry up, and I'm finishing law school, so we're mostly in debt, not a lot of assets, but that's how we're going to try to save money.
And what's the business that's drying up?
My husband does corporate theater. I used to do it with him. He does sort of graphic design and big event productions, and I mean, that's sort of a fluff industry. These are very expensive conventions that I'd imagine the corporations he works for are going to cut back on whenever things get tight.
I should have gotten in that last AIG convention in New York. That was apparently a humdinger.
Was not atypical. I've been to $2 million, you know, 3-day functions.
Yeah, Liz Pulliam Weston, planting a garden, raising some chickens. If you're zoned for it, if it's okay, that seems to me not crazy at all.
Not crazy at all, and it's, you know, not only is it good for helping to reduce the grocery bill, it's wonderful therapy to be out there in the soil, and you feel, again, like you're doing something, you're taking control. It's a great idea, and good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Celeste. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and let's go now to Karen, and Karen's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to say I feel very fortunate because I'm a nurse, and it seems even in this tough economy, people still aren't slowing down having babies, and that's what I do, so I'm very lucky with that. But my plans are never having to get a loan again. I'm going to pay cash for my next car, and unless I want to buy real estate for rental purchase, you know, for rental property. And as far as credit cards, not using them at all, unless, again, it's 0% financing for a year or something like that. But I typically have the money already saved up for that item.
Well, it's an enviable position to be in. But Liz Pulliam Weston, if you can do it, that's what you should do, right?
Well, almost. I would continue to use those credit cards. Just use the money that you've saved up to pay them off in full every month. Because if you expect to get real estate or another loan in the future, you're going to want to have good, strong credit scores. To have good, strong credit scores, you have to have and use credit. So keep those credit card actives. Just don't carry a balance.
Okay.
And nursing,
and
if you think about going into a career in nursing, you could do a lot worse than nursing.
Yeah, it's a great field.
Good luck to you, Tech Karen.
Thank you.
Here's an email question. This is from Mark. Any information about how credit card interest rates are increasing and how that's impacting households and small businesses? First to you, Todd McCracken. Is it going up for small businesses?
Anecdotally, it certainly seems to be. And not only is it rates going up, but the access is going down. And this is a pretty critical time right now. I mean, I would agree that it's bad for consumers to get too deeply in debt. But from a business perspective, you really need to borrow money. It's smart business practice to borrow money at certain times. Right now, for instance, a lot of businesses need to be stocking up on inventory for the holidays. And they often do that on credit because it takes a lot of money up front to get those goods in the door.
It's going to take a strong stomach to stock your store for Christmas this year.
Indeed it is. But you got to have the money up front to do it. That might be a credit card. That might be another kind of loan that's drying up.
Liz Pulliam Weston from the consumer side?
Yeah, we've been seeing this. Our readers have been talking about this since earlier this year. And it's not just that interest rates are being raised on people who miss their payments. It's being raised blanket. Several issuers have gone out there and doubled or tripled people's interest rates. The good news is if you still have good credit, you can push back. If you have credit scores over, say, 720, you can get a better offer somewhere else, and they know it. So if you call up your issuer and say, I don't want to accept this, chances are if you push hard enough, they will back off. Or you can take the opportunity to go to bankrate.com or cardratings.com, find a better deal and transfer your balance if you have one.
Here's another email question on this point from Tom Fitzpatrick. What I found is when a bank lowers my credit card limit, it has a negative impact on my credit score, making it harder for me to get other loans. Why is that?
He's exactly right. When they close down a line of credit or reduce it, it has a very negative impact on your credit scores, and then that does reduce your ability to access other credit. And it's one of those catch-22s. It's like when they raise your interest rates, then it's harder to make the payments and you're more likely to fall behind. It makes sense from a business perspective, but from the consumer, it just pushes you farther and farther back.
Let's go to John. John's on the line with us from Los Gatos in California.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I had a business about 3 years ago, which was doing very well. I was importing FSC-certified hardwoods from Brazil in container load quantities for U.S. companies. And in order to finance that business, I opened up a $500,000 equity line on my personal property because as a new business, I didn't have a credit standing worthy of getting bank financing. Well, first of all, of course, the credit line, you know, like everyone else's that I've spoken to, was reduced from $500,000 down to just over $100,000, which limited my ability to be able to finance these purchases for my customers. I had to float these purchases for about 30 days. And then, just to add insult to injury, the devaluation of the dollar internationally put me in a situation where these types of woods are more expensive for the end user, but most customers were willing to pay 25% extra in order to get them and know that they were sustainably harvested and not pirate products. But with the dollar devaluation, I was now asking customers to pay as much as 200% more for a sustainably harvested product over a pirate product.
So obviously the lower dollar, good if you're an exporter, not so good if you're an importer.
Exactly. So between the combination of the two, I am now out of business, working for a company here in the Bay Area that helps people find ecological alternatives to wood products.
And what were people using that wood for, John?
We had customers, Fender guitar, Promark drumsticks. There were also companies that were manufacturing homes using material for siding. Manufacturing, there were many different applications.
I wonder, Todd McCracken, if this story sounds familiar to you.
It sounds very familiar to me. And it's, you know, here's someone who started a business using at least a personal property equity, I'm guessing the home equity, to get it started.
Yeah.
And that happens all the time. And that's one of my chief worries about how we move out of this environment, because historically small businesses, startups, have really led us out of these situations, and people who have been laid off or left at a large corporation for some reason will start these companies that can grow very rapidly, but they have to have resources, and it's usually the value of their home and their 401k plans. And with what's been happening in those two areas recently, that really makes me worry about how those future businesses are going to start.
John, good luck to you.
On a side note, I just wanted to mention, you know, beyond myself and the problems it's caused for me, FSC-certified woods on the West Coast are now declining in use. We were on our way building up, a fairly good industry on the West Coast using these products. And now a lot of the mills in Brazil that I used to work with are finding it difficult to stay afloat. So it's really affecting the entire industry globally.
Yeah, you forget these are our problems locally, but they have ripple effects around the world.
Yeah. We often talk about how the low dollar has helped exporters, and we often don't think about the flip side and all the jobs and companies that are really thrive around imports.
John,
when I opened my business, the exchange rate was 3.4 reals to a dollar. It bottomed out at about 1.59, and it's just started to regain, but it's still only at, I think, 2.13. So it really affected us hard.
Any idea that even if things started to turn around, it doesn't sound like you could get on your feet again very quickly?
Well, without having the ability to finance these purchases for at least 30 to 45 days, which is what I was doing with my equity line, I don't see how it's possible, really.
But you did hang on to the house?
oh, I've got the house and the equity's still there. I just can't touch it.
John, good luck. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking with Liz Pulliam-Weston, a personal finance columnist for MSN Money and the author of Easy Money, How to Simplify Your Finances and Get What You Want Out of Life, and with Todd McCracken, the president of the National Small Business Association. What is your contingency plan, whether that plan is drawn up on the family table or in the boardroom? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Clinton on the line. Clinton from Homewood in Alabama.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I, like a lot of people, when I look at my 401k and I see what a pummeling it's taking and I have a company match, I'm wondering if it just makes sense for me to lower that contribution to the company match and take what I would ordinarily put into that to pay off my credit cards, because obviously the interest rate on that is a lot worse than the, you know, I'm losing... You know what I'm saying? The balance of of interest on those credit cards is not being matched by any income from my 401k.
So, in other words, your company puts in, what, 10% of your salary, something like that, and you're matching?
My company has 3% match.
Okay. Liz Pulliam-Weston, what's your advice for Clinton?
Well, I'm delighted to hear that Clinton's not considering bailing out entirely, because I've heard way too much of that, and that's just a loser's game. Most of us need the returns from the stock market to have any hope.
This is short term.
Yeah, exactly. I would look at and make sure that you're saving enough for retirement with that lower match. You probably won't be. If you want to take the risk of lowering it for, you know, a few months to get caught up with the credit cards, that could be okay. Just don't make this a permanent part of your lifestyle to underfund your retirement, because you really are going to need that money someday.
Right. But do you think that with the present environment, it makes a whole lot of sense to put a whole lot of money into those plans?
Well, you know, there's one way to look at it, that we're having a heck of a sale on stocks right now. I don't know if that's
exactly
true, and I don't know if when it will bounce back. But in my mind, you stay invested, you keep investing no matter what, and that's
right.
What over time will build your wealth. You keep
right.
that discipline of investing.
Right.
But if you do have high-rate credit card debt, sometimes it can make sense to crank back to where you're still getting the full company match. You don't want to give up that free money.
Oh, no.
But to put the extra money towards paying down those credit cards.
Well, that's the plan for the time being.
Yeah, and I wouldn't, like I said, I wouldn't make that a years-long process. If you're talking about reducing your contribution for the next 5 years, I wouldn't do it. But if you're talking about just a few months to try to get caught up, that can be, you know, that can be an okay way to do it.
Okay.
Clinton, good
Thank
luck. And Liz Pulliam, I have to ask you, both of the presidential campaigns at this point are talking about saying that, well, you can have penalty-free withdrawals from your 401k temporarily to $10,000, something like that. Again, some people may find themselves in such a situation, it's not law yet, but they may find themselves in a situation where they may want to do that. But you point out people are going to need that money someday when they retire.
Yeah, it's such a bad idea to take money out of a retirement account prematurely. And the penalties are actually the smallest part of the cost. I mean, first you're paying income taxes on those withdrawals, but even worse, you're losing the future tax-deferred returns you could have earned on that money. And if you figure you got 30 years until retirement, every $1,000 you take out now is going to cost you $10,000 in lost future retirement income. If you've got 40 years till retirement, you're losing $20,000. So the younger you are, actually, the worse idea it is. A lot of young people think they can just make it back, but it's because of that wonderful value of compounding over time. You really get hit if you take that money out. So I wouldn't encourage it. I'd try to find some other way to pay the bills other than raiding those retirement accounts.
And Todd McCracken, quickly, small businesses, of course, are the engine of our economy. I'm sure you have people who are thinking up great ideas right now and wondering, should I start a business now? Because, you know, if I did get it going, it will prosper.
Yeah, not just starting the businesses, but also for existing businesses. They may have all kinds of plans on the
for expansion,
for new markets they want to enter. And, you know, in this kind of environment, all that's on hold, waiting to see what's going to happen. And so to some extent, an economic decline becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because of that kind of behavior. But it's certainly what I would advise right now for people.
Todd McCracken, thanks very much for your time.
It's good to be here.
Todd McCracken, president of the National Small Business Association, with us here in Studio 3A. Our thanks as well to Liz Pulliam-Weston, a personal finance columnist with us from NPR West. And Liz, always good to talk with you.
Likewise, Neil. Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to be talking about, well, after months of campaigning, attack ads and rebuttals, how can anybody still be undecided? If you are, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We're going to be talking with a writer who says, well, undecideds don't make that much difference. And, well, they're really not all that undecided when you come to think of it at the end anyway. Give us a call. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Polls show that somewhere between 5 and 13% of voters are undecided, and the presidential campaigns, the media, and pollsters focus on this slim segment of the electorate. Writer Ezra Klein doesn't buy it. He argues in a recent Los Angeles Times op-ed that from a civic standpoint, few creatures are as contemptible, and they don't actually decide many elections. Besides, they may not really exist. So, undecided voters, call and tell us who you are and why you deserve all the attention showered on you in the run-up to Election Day. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Ezra Klein is associate editor of the American Prospect magazine and joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
How you doing, Neil?
Civically contemptible?
I knew that word was going to get me. The argument here is that if you're a political junkie, if you're a political operative, and the original sentence said something about in Washington, few voters are considered as civically contemptible, it's a very odd thing to watch for the people in this town. Been here for 2 years. There's been an election that's been on every form of news media, from your show to newspapers to the guy on your street corner with the big sign who stands out and yells at traffic. The election has been there. And you've got two candidates who honestly could not exhibit a starker contrast if they tried. I mean, from skin color to ideology to advisors to party. And then some people wake up every day and they're sort of like, I don't know. Seems sort of hard to figure out. And if you take that seriously, then they're an extremely odd subsegment of the electorate. But the actual point of the op-ed is that I don't think those people are undecided fundamentally. I think that the political science research into them tends to show that what you really have in undecided voters are people who are a little bit less willing to say who they're voting for quite a while. I mean, on some level, we're all a little bit undecided, right? There are scenarios in which just about anybody would change their vote. If Barack Obama personally collars Osama bin Laden during a fact-finding trip in Afghanistan, I think a lot of Republicans are going to say, you know what, he may be pretty tough after all. If John McCain leaves one of his 12 garages tomorrow and found a new renewable, clean, cheap type of energy while he was doing some tinkering, I think a lot of Greens may say, you know what, this guy may have something to offer the country. But to actually be undecided at this point, the election tends to be pretty rare. And so I talk about some research in there by two political scientists, Adam Clymer and I want to get the name right here, but I'm forgetting it. So Adam Clymer and in the book Swing Voters, and they say that they looked at the National Election Survey data. And in October, they looked at the 4% who were truly undecided, said they had no lean. And they had them do what's called a thermometer poll, where you say, how much do you favor one candidate or another, 1 to 100? And it turned out that whichever candidate got even slightly higher when they did that test.
Mm-hmm. 51 over 49, even if it was that little.
Even if it was that little, you saw 80% and more of that undecided voters go towards that candidate. So fundamentally, these folks weren't very undecided at all. They basically knew who they were going to vote for, and they just, you know, I mean, they weren't quite ready to express a preference.
So procrastinators as opposed to
civically contemptible. Very good way of putting it.
There are people who do not live inside the beltway of Washington, D.C., and may be focused on their economic problems, may be focused on the Philadelphia Phillies' chances to make the World Series, focused on a lot of different things, and just not focused about the election yet.
That may be true, although, I, as I said, I don't see much evidence that there really are. I mean, that's the problem, that if there were more, it's one thing to not be focused in July or August, but fundamentally the vast majority of voters have a partisan affiliation. They vote based on that. Yeah, politics fundamentally is tribal. What we do in D.C. is sort of create these complicated intellectual superstructures for what our parents taught us to believe when we were kids, generally. And as I said, it turns out that if you go to the end of the election and you look at these voters, they tend to know who they're going to vote for. So they are paying attention on some level. I actually think that the problem is they're not given enough credit, that fundamentally they are paying attention. They're not just looking at the Phillies. When people are worried about their economic situation, they're actually looking at the paper and saying, my God, I hope somebody's going to help me. We really need someone to do something about this. The question is whether or not they're going to tell the Gallup pollster, I'm voting for Obama, I'm voting for McCain. And I think that one side note to this is that people have a lot of mistrust in government. So I think there's some level on which people are always hoping that they're going to be a little bit more impressed than they are. It's not that they're undecided between the two options they have now, but they're actually hoping something changes so they feel a little bit better about the options they're going to be able to get.
Let's see if we get some undecided voters on the phone. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Our guest is Ezra Klein of the American Prospect. And Bonnie joins us. Bonnie calling from Marietta in Ohio.
Yes.
And are you an undecided voter, Bonnie?
I am. I'm very undecided.
And why is that? After all of certainly Ohio, you can't avoid the political ads this year.
No, you can't. But I'm just undecided because, well, I'm very unhappy with the debates. I don't think we're getting enough information from there. And I just don't think that there's any good information out there. I mean, I can't watch the news anymore, the cable news, because it's so one-sided one way or the other. I'm just completely frustrated with the whole process. Tonight I'm going to see Joe Biden. He's going to be speaking in Marietta, Ohio. And I'm hoping to get, you know, something from the horse's mouth, basically, that'll help me decide one way or the other.
And have you been to, or do you plan to attend any Republican rallies?
I would love to. As far as I know, there isn't one coming to Marietta, but Sarah Palin was in Cambridge, and I didn't know about it soon enough to go. But I'm hoping that either she or John McCain will come in this area so that I just, you know, you watch those debates, and afterwards, the spin, it's almost like they're telling you how to take the information. It's very frustrating.
And do you plan to vote?
I do plan to vote.
And how are you going to make that decision?
I don't know. I don't know. I even tried to go on the internet and, you know, blog and see what people were saying, but it seemed like they were just repeating everything that was on the cable news, you know, the basic, they weren't making any choices based on issues or quoting issues. They were just quoting these bland generalizations, it seems like.
And Bonnie, can I ask, how did your parents vote habitually? Were they habitual Republicans or habitual Democrats?
Well, my mom was a Republican, a Democrat, while I was young. I'm 43 years old, and now she's a Republican, and I'm not sure why she switched. I was always a Democrat, and I voted for Hillary Clinton in the primaries, but I'm just having a hard time getting what I think is true information about the candidates.
All right, Bonnie, good luck.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ezra.
This is actually interesting because what you have in undecided voters are there are a couple types, right? There are what you can call they're nonpartisan undecideds, which are people who they don't like the Republican Party, they don't like the Democratic Party. So sort of every year they vote for, you know, they would be Perot voters a couple of years
ago.
Or
Ron Paul.
Or Ron Paul voters. Well, a little bit less so. He's a bit more marginal than Perot was. But what you also have, and this is interesting because you don't get them in the primaries, is voters who are dissatisfied with their party's choice. These are not voters who persist in being undecided or being swing or being confused from election to election. They're voters who, that election, they were involved in the primary. They supported, as Bonnie did, Hillary Clinton. Their candidate did not win. And so until fairly late in the game, they tend to be undecided, in part as a result of that. Again, you know, you can't use the aggregate data to predict any one person. Where Bonnie will go will have a lot to do with, you know, I guess, what Joe Biden says tonight or in a week or whatever. But in general, they break very, very heavily towards whichever party they voted for in the primary. That tends to be the scenario of it, that there's a lot of lingering mistrust of the candidate who they did not support in the primary. But at the end of the day, the party affiliation tends to be stronger than the feelings of betrayal. Because frankly, if you were a Hillary Clinton supporter, Barack Obama is much closer to everything you apparently believe than John McCain is. I mean, there's literally not an issue where the two of that, where John McCain stacks up better to Hillary Clinton than Barack Obama does. But you still may not feel great about him given the biases you picked up and beliefs you picked up and, you know, anger you picked up during the primary.
And may remember the criticisms your
exactly.
candidate had
very much.
Against him. And anyway, here's an email, from Alice. I am an undecided voter in California, not sure if I should vote for Barack Obama or Cynthia McKinney. California will almost certainly go to Obama, so I'm considering giving a vote to a third party that I also believe in, hopes to give it more attention and power. If I lived in the states where the chances of McCain were tighter, I would vote for Obama. So this is a strategic voter.
Right. I wouldn't call that undecided. That's a very tactical move.
Here's one from Jeremy in Aloha, Oregon. I don't know who to vote for because neither of the candidates have explained what they are really going to accomplish now that the Bush administration has allowed all of our capital to bail out Wall Street. So,
you know, I have to say, I mean, this does get into what you were saying about people paying attention to other things. I'm never quite sure how to take the thing that the problem is the candidates aren't offering any ideas or any what the candidates are offering are a lot of ideas that they probably will not be able to implement because Congress is biased towards obstruction and so forth. But the idea that what they don't have are a lot of plans for what they're going to do is always struck me as very odd. And I tend to think it's a way that folks...
These are people who've never been to either of their websites.
But it's not even that. I think people don't trust. And I think you were hearing that from Bonnie in there, too. I don't think it's that they it's a little bit hard to put into words, I think, the fact that the political system fails us. It fails us over and over and over again. It is rotted to its core. I think you have a situation right now where people know. I mean, you have global warming coming in 30 or 40 or 50 years with terrible consequences. You have a healthcare system that will break the back of the federal budget within 25 years. And most people will tell you, is anything going to be done? No, it's pretty hard. I mean, there's something broken. I think people sense it. And so when all these folks, you know, year after year run and say they're going to get all this done, I think when they say they don't have a plan, they don't mean they don't have specifics. I always sort of get the sense that they mean they don't actually have a plan of how are we going to get this done. It's like the old joke about economists assume a can opener. You can't assume your policy is going to go through. And it's very hard for these folks to sort of demonstrate why they will be more effective in their actions than will all the candidates and seemingly qualified individuals who ran for this office before them.
We're talking with Ezra Klein of the American Prospect about his op-ed in the Los Angeles Times called Undecided Voters. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to James. James with us from Corona in California.
Yes.
Hi, James. Go ahead, please.
Well, I'm a true independent. I'm one that feels that government should be run like a business. At the beginning of any campaign, you've got either candidate pandering to their base, only telling them what they want to hear. Very few people are very objective about things. So the longer this takes, the more things filter out to a point where they will hopefully answer exactly what their economic policies are, what their international policies are, what their strategies are, what their strengths are. And in this day and age, I was on an aircraft carrier in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and trust me, it was extremely scary. I would like to find out if either one of the candidates has the ability and the willpower to push the button should everything fall, because there is a window in that sort of activities of maybe 2.5 minutes that you have to have the guts to call a first strike or else all of your first strike capabilities are taken out.
James, I think we can all hope and pray that we don't ever discover whichever our presidential candidate wins has the nerve to do that.
Well, that's one of the aspects. The other thing is who's going to run the government like a business as opposed to pandering to either side.
And how do you make your decision, James?
Well, I will make my decision in the final debate of which candidate has the balls, basically, to tell the American people exactly what their economic policies are. And do they have the nerve to defend the country?
James,
under extreme circumstances.
James, I don't mean to anticipate the future, but you may be disappointed. The debates thus far have not answered those questions.
Pardon?
You may be disappointed. We've not heard those answers in the debate. Anyway, thanks very much for the phone call.
Well, that could possibly be true, but it's the one who filters out to finally is forced to telling the more specific truth.
Okay.
And I think the more time it takes, the more people get pressed to the wall to answer those questions.
All right, James. Thanks very much for the call.
The fact that Republicans don't have James solidly on their side right now is real evidence of the trouble John McCain is in. Because you listen to what he just said, right? Government run like a business. And who has the, what do you basically say, the cojones to nuke someone? That's not the sort of metric that you generally get we're going to elect an Illinois liberal. We're going to elect a Massachusetts Democrat. But I do think what you are seeing is a certain level of ideological feeling of being unsettled. There's so much failure among these folks right now. There's so much failure in what the Republicans have done with control of the country for the past couple of years. A lot of people who I think would normally, you know, basically know where they lean are having trouble coming to grips with what that would mean again.
And this would argue against, you cite a political scientist by the name of Paul Lazarsfeld from the 1940s, who argued that campaigns are essentially over before they begin, that in fact what the campaigns do is accomplish the same thing that the chemicals do in the photographic process, where they bring out the picture, but they can only bring out the picture that is there already. There's a template that's established, and James will vote Republican.
I don't know that James will.
The Jameses of the world.
But. The Jameses of the world could. Well, what he would say is that events matter, right? What he would say is that it's not that it started before. It's not about party affiliation. It's more complicated than that. Events matter. And so part of the photograph of the election would be this financial crisis, right? This is not something created by either, despite what the two of them may say. Neither Barack Obama nor John McCain, I'm very bipartisan here, created the financial crisis. But that was a serious definitional event in the election. And a month ago, John McCain was ahead. I feel like people are forgetting this. A month and a half ago, then this happened. This is the sort of thing that really, really tends to militate towards Democrats. And now Barack Obama is ahead. That's part of what that political scientist was talking about. That, you know, we like to say that politics are about campaigns, and we do that in large part because the media likes to cover politics as being about campaigns.
They also take out a lot of ads on radio and television stations.
They take out ads, etc. But frankly, politics is really in large part about events. Candidates tend to win when their incumbents in the economy is doing well. They lose if their incumbents in the economy is doing poorly. And I think, and similarly on foreign policy, they lose when the foreign policy situation is unsettled and scary and they're judged to have done a poor job, and they win when that's not true. And I think what you're seeing for Republicans, for McCain, with people like James, is simply that people feel unsettled with Republicans, and the election is breaking in much the way you would have predicted a year ago if you had known about a financial crisis.
We'll end with this email from Thomas in Salt Lake City. I'm an undecided voter and not uninformed. I listen to NPR. I'm undecided because I believe I cannot know what the best option is for the whole nation, and I don't think anybody does. I have to believe that to take a strong stand on any decisions, I need to understand all sides thoroughly, something I believe no one can. So I view people with strong opinions and unmovable in their stances as mostly underinformed. Well, in any case, Ezra Klein, a man of strong opinions and informed, thanks very much for your time
today.
Thank you. Ezra Klein is associate editor of the American Prospect magazine. His op-ed appeared in Sunday's Los Angeles Times, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. We'll be with you from Roanoke, Virginia tomorrow. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.